Welcome to The Hours. We're excited to spend some more hours with you, our Savvy Coaching community. I get pumped up. I spend a good amount of time thinking about this conversation prior to it, taking notes, preparing. For me, a little bit, it's almost like a video journal of, okay, here's what I've learned. Here's what I'm thinking about. Here's what I want to leave as a coaching legacy. So I'm excited to be here. Mark, I know you're excited to be here. Mark, let me start off with this question. What's one interesting or surprising observation you've made about the basketball world this week, whether it be through the media, game watching, conversations? Interesting or surprising observation?
Man, put me on the spot. I would go through coaching conversations, and it kind of goes with our cohort, I guess. So it's probably just top of mind is coaches really need direction on the off season more than you would think. And I don't mean that as like a slight or anything, just a lot of the consulting calls that I've been on, it seems like coaches are like, okay, hey, season's over. Now what do I do? Give me something. Give me something for me or my assistant coaches. So maybe that. I don't know. That was just kind of surprising to me. Some of them have said, hey, look, I have these things that I do, but just don't feel like it's enough. So I guess that would be the one thing that would be somewhat surprising.
Yeah, that's good. Okay, off season. It's literally named off season. Like, you should be off. Do you feel like coaches take enough of an off season for themselves, and players take enough of an off season? That's something that I've been struggling with. Like, what's the right balance there?
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, as a basketball junkie, it's catch 22. It's a blessing and a curse. But I would say, more unfortunately for players, that they're now year round unless they're playing another sport.
Yeah.
A lot of AAU programs are starting before the high school season even ends. They're having tryouts, and then they play a bunch of games, and you got your summer league, and then you got fall where you're starting. Some states play fall ball. All that is, it's a lot. And I think one thing I've tried to manage later in my coaching career was burnout with players. 'Cause I think most high school players, you have basketball players, and then you have kids that like to play basketball. And if you're a kid that likes to play basketball, it's really tough to do that year round without a lot of breaks. For coaches, I think, you know, like anything, there's a lot of different types of coaches. I was the type of coach where right after the season, and give me 2 weeks away. Like, just, I need a break, because usually, you know, for only one team, it ends in a good way, the championship. So everybody else is a little beat up. I wanted a couple weeks away. I know some coaches just grind all the way through. And then honestly, I think there's a bucket of coaches that get away for a very, very long time, probably too long, and they don't maximize their off season.
Gosh, none of this was on my list to talk about, but all of it I find interesting. And that's really what, you know, for those of you listening, that's really what The Hours is like, all right, what do Mark and I find interesting, relevant, and helpful? And give us feedback. We would love more feedback of, I love that topic, more of that, please. Or, hey, you know, quit talking about your cats. I don't care about your cats. Which I do have a mug that says Cat Daddy. It's nothing like you're thinking, but like, when we were snowboarding between Washington and Phoenix for years, I would drive our cats in our car down from Washington while my family flew. And I had leashes. I would take the cats for walks on stops to go to the bathroom. And so I got the nickname Cat Daddy. I did it for my kids. I don't actually like cats that much.
That's funny.
So yeah, like, no more talking about that. I apologize. All right. Three things came up there that I think are worth diving into. I'll go with the quickest one first. There's been a lot said about the growth of year-round basketball participation, the growth of AAU, especially here in North America. And it's related to injuries. You know, one case study I think that's been used a lot is Zion Williamson. Like, he's been playing year round since, you know, a very, very young age. He's been on a high, you know, this under a microscope. And so he's always just going hard. And that wasn't necessarily the case. And it's probably led to being a little bit more injury prone with having played so much more year round. I think the science is still out on that because we don't have a great data, but that's definitely a narrative that exists. Do you have an opinion on that narrative? Do you think that that's leading to more injuries later in their career?
Yeah, and I think what I've read is that it is the repeated use of the same muscles. So a pitcher pitching year round, you know, it's just the same movement, the same joints, the same muscles taking that beating. Where even if you're playing sports year round, if you go from basketball to baseball, where you're using different, you know, you're putting stress on different joints. So, and I think, I mean, I don't want to say this for sure, but I think the science has been out on that of just the repeated use of the same joints and muscles, ligaments.
Yeah. And so different joints and muscles would be an argument for multi-sport participation.
Correct.
Yeah. I would say that and you and I have both gotten to work with a lot of high school programs and AAU programs. It is rare for me to see a high school or AAU program that puts a high priority on effective dynamic warmups and teaching players how to recover from a standpoint of stretching, with cold plunging, rest, all of these things. And I would actually argue for coaches that are listening, probably the greatest impact that a player can have on your season isn't their development or even their performance. It's their availability.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you've got like a 5% window if you can get your player to perform well, but if they go from available to unavailable because of season ending injury, that will derail your season. So 5 more minutes of pre-practice shooting is actually not as valuable as 5 more minutes of pre-practice movement prep or strengthening your stabilizing muscles around your joints or whatever. So I would really, really argue for a greater attention to that in the future.
Yep, I agree. I think there is there's probably a certain group of coaches that are still doing static stretching before practice, which we tried to do after. I always found too that our best practices is when we lifted before. So in season practice, we would go get a 30-minute lift, high intensity, very low volume. But what it did is it just primed the central nervous system to where when we walked in the gym, our dudes were so ready, you know. That was the best warm-up we could have. And, you know, I've seen coaches too use dynamic warm-up. Like, there's a really good coach in the New Orleans area, won a few state titles, and went and watched one of his practices, and his dynamic warm-up was very lackadaisical, right? Yeah. It would be hard to call it dynamic. So I asked him about it. I said, man, y'all are not, you know, your dynamic warm-up was very not dynamic. And he's like, oh yeah, it's horrible. I just use it as a mental break between school and practice. He said, they think it's important. They want to do it. So they called it was their mascot time. So, you know, if they were the Bears, it'd just be bear time. And it was basically do your thing, but just know that this is the buffer from class to practice. And once we're done with this, you got to be ready to go at least mentally. And then he was like, physically, I'll get them warmed up in the start of practice. But I felt that was interesting too, where, you know, if you're going to do dynamic, let's do it right. If you're not going to do it, maybe you use it for a mental break.
Yeah. Well, here, let me actually switch to a little film right now. I was going to do this a little bit later. So we have something that I put together at Savvy called Squid, which is our dynamic warm-up. And I need to do a better filming job on that. That is a mini course coming up. This is actually getting into our vitamins, but if we're talking about injury prevention, this is actually one of my favorite things to do for injury prevention. And it's actually our protection plan progression. Big shout out to Steve Novak on this, but it's about deceleration. And deceleration is really what strengthens your stabilizing muscles. So this is just, you know, most of our players know this, we're onboarding some new ones, but this is just like a two dribble in what we call pickups. And you'll get to see them kind of work in the background here. And it's just two dribbles to explode and then a single leg stop and balance. And the ability to tighten your core and tighten the muscles around your knees and your ankles to actually hold that balance position like we see, her name is Lacey, like we see Lacey right here with the same leg, same cheek pickup and balance. That's a great thing to incorporate into your dynamic warm-up. So this is just level one. Maybe you want to use this one. We're doing this at all of our youth ages, right? So it's two dribble explode and then a one leg, 1 second balance. We got different levels of player here, but this is just going to be level one. And what we go pickups, our players do it as part of that kind of transition time as we're going into practice, working on their ability to decelerate. I'll continue through kind of these different progressions here. That's level one that we call pickups. They'll go out with their left hand, back with their right hand, two dribbles, pick up a 1/1000 fight for balance. They cannot explode into the next dribble until they have complete balance and control. They're not hopping around anymore. Obviously different levels of execution, plenty of opportunities to coach. This is our next level. And our next level here is what we call our protect. And it's where we go from our balance. You'll see me demonstrating here. We go from our balance, right, where I'm balancing, and then we sit into our protection position where we're going to getting low. So anytime we don't have a nine is what we're trying to connect the dots here. We hunt for nines. We don't have a nine. We go into a protection plan. And that's more important than working on finishing moves is when not to finish. So we're actually teaching, this will connect to some content we have a little bit later here. It'll connect to the dots to our principles then being played out in every game or drill that we do. And so like our principle is our shots. That's one of our highest level principles on offense and defense. Our shots is like the first order of teaching. So our shots is being taught here in our pre-practice vitamins. Our shots are nines. You hunt nines. When you don't have nines, you go into protection plan. So like even our vitamins are being connected to our principles, right? So now they go into their protects, right? Two dribbles and protects. So I'll fast forward and show you a little bit here. Good. So now they're going into the same footwork and they're going into, gosh, this is a beautiful freeze frame. Let me back it up. Oh, I would love to see players play this low this often. And there's so much technique stuff and I'm really proud of what they're doing here. Right. And so we do this every day. A vitamin is something you do every day and you take it because it's good for you. Again, going out with one hand, back with the other. There's so much to teach about their footwork and cleanup here, but they get better over time. And this is another little teaching point. So when we do this, I'm not stopping and correcting everything that we see. If they're just moving, stopping and getting low over time, they're going to get better. I will give them one thing as a group to focus on when we do this every day. Now for us, every day is, you know, 1 or 2 days a week, right? But in a high school season, it's every day. Don't try to get it perfect on day one. Move through it and use the concept of Kaizen, right? Continuous improvement, 1% better every day. And you see that there's different players that are getting better at different rates. Now we'll be giving individual feedback. You see our assistant coaches are doing a really good job going through and giving individual touches and feedback. Because I don't want our assistant coaches stopping this at all, right? We got stuff to get through. I'll be the only one that stops it. They know that they're giving one-on-one coaching. The only time, and we've established this as our mode of operation, the only time an assistant coach gets to speak to the group is when I bring the group in and they tell me in advance what they want to say. They don't get to piggyback anything. They're like, hey, I'm seeing this thing. I'll be like, that's good. Do it at the next break. Right? Otherwise, all their coaching is one-on-one. All right, so that's our second. We call it protect. Progression one, pick up. Progression two, protect. Progression three, safe. Again, big shout out and thank you to Steve Novak. I also want to say Doug Novak because of the NBA player Doug Novak. But anyway, Steve Novak on really informing what we're doing here. So now we connect the dots from our pickup, which you can see, right-hand dribble, right-foot pickup, into our protect, which is what we do whenever we don't have a nine, into our safe. And our safe pivot is getting space to get safe, space from the defense to then make a better read and better pass. Now we use this mark first as a passing footwork. I know that Doug uses it a lot as a finishing footwork, which we would then progress to, but I don't want everyone trying to finish off of these pivots. a lot of them don't have that skill set yet. I want everyone to be able to pass off these pivots. So we do more of the finishing stuff in our individual, but that would be our safe pivot. So then we just flow right into it. So some of these girls are actually seeing this for the very first time, but you can see it. Everyone's just getting their reps. This is also really good for, of course, pivoting, balance, and dynamic warm-up. So I just wanted to show an example. I know you have some thoughts here, Mark. I just want to show an example of how you could connect. All right, see Nina here. This is her first time doing it. She's in the middle of your screen, right? Okay, good job, Nina, going into your pivots. Okay, great. Okay, I would get, obviously, we would want Nina to have her hips lower, her feet wider, and the ball closer to her cheek on this, like she's talking on a cell phone. And let's see how Nina does on her pivot. Okay, nice. Way to get to your pivot right away, Nina. And like excellent stuff off the jump. So we just do that every single day. This whole progression should take 2 minutes total. And they're getting ball control, they're getting pivot work, and they're also getting some dynamic warm-up and pivots. Mark, anything that you want to add on this stuff?
I should have been taking notes. I got a ton. So I'll probably forget half of it. But yeah. I loved just right there. I was going to say, as a coach, I love that you're not stopping it and you've established yourself as one, the lead coach. So if we are going to stop it, one coach is going to stop it. So you would be the lead coach, all the assistants are the support coach, which means they're doing maybe more of their coaching on the side. Once they finish their rep, they're in the back of the line. And then we might give them an external cue instead of, you know, saying, hey, you know, do this, do that. External cue that you just used that I really like was, I'd like to have the ball higher, like she's talking on a cell phone. Perfect. Everybody knows how to do that. So, hey, bring that ball as if you were talking on the cell phone. All right, there you go, right there. 33 just did a nice shot. So, love that. I love that you're not stopping it because this is the warm up, right? So it doesn't have to be super clean. We're gonna get 1% better, like you said. But primary objective is that we're getting warmed up. So if it doesn't look 100% okay, that's fine. I think a lot of things that come up in consulting calls is, yeah, we ran late. It took us longer to get through some of the early stuff. You know, I think you can get away from it and always hit on it the next day. Gosh, I was going to say a couple other.
While you're thinking, I'll throw one more thing in. We'll just keep popcorn because that's so good. So, Phil Handy, I got to do a clinic with Phil Handy. You probably know he's an assistant coach of the Los Angeles Lakers. He's become really popular since his relationship with LeBron James. Awesome and genuine, humble guy. I can't say enough. I love my time with him. He has a principle. So we went through his core principles of a coach, and he's older now, but he still executes this principle, which is, and I'm going to challenge coaches on this one, team coaches. Here's one of his principles. They sweat, you sweat. They sweat, you sweat. Now, that can look different for everyone. I know that everyone has different physical abilities, injuries, age. I understand that. What does sweat look like? It means that you're giving your physicality to it as well. That means that you're giving effort to it as well. And so often we see head coaches like just standing on the side with their arms crossed over their chest and watching. And I'm like, at least move around. At least move around the court. I've heard that. So I developed a relationship with a guy named Mike Doliak as well. He played a little bit in the NBA, but he played at Utah for Rick Majerus. And he's told me the most amazing Rick Majerus stories, who, you know, was not in good shape, incredibly overweight. But he's like, Rick Majerus carried a towel around practice because of how much he was sweating in practice. Like, he was always moving up and down the floor, getting touches. Like, it upsets me, honestly, when coaches just stand still. Like, and you know, you can look at me like I'm the lead coach in the situation, but I'm operating here in an assistant coach capacity. It's like, I'm not watching the gym, right? I'm going and coaching somebody. I'm giving them individual touches. And if I have an assistant coach that's standing on the sideline and watching, I'm getting on their butt. Like, what are you doing right now? You have a job to do. You're either lazy or you're stupid, right? Like stupid means you don't have an eye or you don't have anything to say. And let me give you something. Just go and give them a high five and say, Nina, good job. Or lazy means you're just not giving effort. Like, you should be active whenever we're doing anything group-wide like this. So just wanted to make that point as well. And maybe you have some more that came back to you there.
Yeah. just on that note, I would say one thing I was going to say, if coaches are not moving around or standing, they probably lack confidence too, and don't know, like you said, don't know what to coach. So if you have assistant coaches doing that, I would just recommend give them one thing to look for, right? Hey, let's just make sure we're, even if it's we're jogging on and off the floor in between reps or when we sub, just give them something to be engaged about. And I think it's really important for coaches to just change their vantage point throughout practice.
That's
anyway.
Even if, changing your vantage point, that's so good.
Yeah. What I was going to say too is right when you put this clip on, and I had seen it, we had just uploaded it to the site or dropped it in the community chat. But that's how we teach a stride stop. What they're essentially doing is a stride stop there, right? So we would teach the stride stop. Like you said, Coach Novak teaches finishing through that. You teach passing first. And I think what's important, just a skill development note, is one, this is all technique stuff. So I love that you are connecting it to the principle of when you would use this, right? If you don't have a nine, then we stop. And use our protection plan. So really, really good, because skill is being able to do it, but knowing when to do it and being able to do it at game speed. And I get a lot of questions on, you know, order of skill work or how to develop some finishes. We always worked on stopping first, because that stride stop is the same footwork you would use for your finishes. If you don't have your finishes, you could donut or just pivot out of pressure and play. So much transfer there, and you're getting that in the warm-up. Last thing I'll say is I have been engaged in a war on drills for a long time, because I believe in gamifying as many things as we can, because that's more fun, more engaging, higher level of transfer, all of those things. But there's a play, like this would be considered block practice, and there is a place for that. And I think the best place for that is in the warm up. So, man, there are so many things that I love about just that simple drill. But knowing that this is teaching technique, the real value in is teaching players when to do that and can they make that read on the fly, is that's where the money is.
Exactly. And that's what then I would encourage coaches to progress into and connect the dots, like connect the dots between your pre-practice, your vitamin work, and your actual gamification.
Here's a way to gamify it, or a way to add.
You want me to stop share?
Say again.
Did you want me to stop sharing? You want to share
something? Yeah. No. I don't have to share, but to teach players or give them the game context, we would like to play a game called Either Or. So we could start with a small advantage. Tyler's got the ball. I'm on his shoulder side to side. And his constraint is either you get a 1 foot finish, meaning Tyler creates separation, big advantage, or a nine at the rim. So you either have a nine off 1 foot or a stride stop, or what we, you know, calling a protection plan here. So that, you know, you always say when you remove something, things, it makes it very clear. So you remove everything else other than a 1 foot finish. And then now players can start to get that feel of, all right, I'm getting through the elbow here. I don't have a nine. So now I'm using my stride stop. Oh, you went to mute.
There we go. Am I back?
You're back.
Thank you. We haven't spoken about this yet, Mark, but you know, so how I've structured our vocabulary is a stride stop is one protection plan, meaning multiple. So like a Barkley would be another protection plan. So we have all these different protection plans, and for us, it's like, if no nine, you go to protection plans. Like a bounce back or a pullback dribble would be another protection plan. If no nine, protect. For some players, when they catch the ball on the perimeter, they need to, if no advantage or if no pass, they need a protection plan without dribbling. Like they just have to, like, there's some players that just need to protect it on the perimeter and then use, you know, their protection plans just to pivot off the catch. And that would be, you know, in line with your reads, you know. So the second principle that I wanted to share, and then I know you'll have a lot more on this as well, Mark, and this is going to be a progression. So this is Q1 of our practice now. So I do a four quarter practice. It's just simple. It's how I like to structure it. And we are connecting in Q1 of this practice to all of our principles, but specifically protection plans. So this is the second principle that I wanted to share today. And it's actually the main principle that I wanted to share today, which is basically get your degradation to zero. Practice messy to get your degradation to zero. So we're like, I grew up and was coached very heavily on, you got to shoot 30% better in your training than you can expect to shoot in games. And I understand the concept, and there is a reality to it. But I actually believe that that expectation of, I've got to shoot 70% in practice if I ever want to be, or in my training, if I ever want to be a 40% three-point shooter in the games, because that's the reality. That is the reality of the drop-off or the degradation of performance when you add pressure, when you add defense, when you add speed, and all these things equal to stress. They add some level of stress. I would now propose that getting degradation to zero is near impossible, but it is a goal. And so if you have a high level of degradation in your performance, you know, it's really easy to talk about individual shooting, but I would suggest all things, execution of your actions to your communication on defense, to how quickly you get matched up in transition, whatever. The goal should actually be to get your degradation to zero. And there's two ways that I know of that you can get your degradation to zero. You can either get better at your execution so that it transfers more to games, or you can actually make your practices or your training more game-like, which doesn't improve your performance. It actually makes your performance worse in practice, but it gets your degradation to zero. And I think, like, I did a podcast yesterday with a guy named Daniel Alexander, and he is a shooting specialist. He works for this company, SIQ, which makes the shooting technology. And so he was asking in particular about shooting, like, why can't players, like, do in games what they do in practice with shooting? And I actually think the answer is mostly because of how they practice shooting. They practice shooting in such a way that they try to estimate the degradation. And they try to, with that same high degradation, 30% degradation, they try to then improve their practice performance so that they can improve their game performance with massive degradation. And that's why it doesn't transfer. And that's why you have inconsistent game performances. The most consistent game performance are, can you get your degradation to zero? So that's the goal for everything, in my opinion. Before I give the example here and show this film of us applying the skill of a protection plan in a gamified scenario, is there anything you want to add about that, Mark, or challenge?
Yeah, no, maybe not so much a challenge, maybe a question. Yeah. And I think you're saying this is, we're going to have the 70% or 80% shooter in practice shoot 30 to 40% in the game because we're doing block shooting where there is no, it's not representative of the game, right? So If your practice is representative, then what we're saying is those percentages should be equal or close to equal from practice to game, right? So that is the reason why games-based or even constraints-led approach practices transfer more so to the game, because the environment is representative to the game. So you might get less reps. This is something else that comes up a lot, is it actually came up in our chat this week, is I feel like, you know, I'm moving to a games-based approach, but I feel like my players aren't getting enough reps. And you are going to get less reps, but every rep is more valuable. So there's more return on every single rep. So 100 block shots out of practice versus 30 shots that are more representative, game speed, game spots with defense, you're going to get more value out of those 30 than you would 100 block reps.
Yeah. And I'll say this as well, and we might disagree on this one, which would be fun. I, for shooting especially, I'd say almost more so than any skill, I value block practice. I just don't think there's any reason to test it. Right. So, like, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, oh, we're going to measure our makes in this block practice. I think that's a waste and misleading. And, you know, so that's why in our shooting system that I've designed for players, or even when I work with players, for me, there's three different approaches or lenses or focuses that we would have whenever we're shooting. You're tuning, you're training, or you're testing. Tuning would be most of our block. And in tuning, there's no measurement of makes. That's not your focus, that's not your win. Your win is actually tuning up some sort of technique or feeling. That's tune-up time. So if we measure our tune-up time for makes and misses, it will distract you on either end of the spectrum. It'll distract you on the makes if you're missing. It's like, this isn't working, but that's not the focus. Or it'll distract you if you're like shooting 9 out of 10, be like, this isn't game like. So don't focus on it. Our focus is just on the tuning of our shot and to find the feeling that we're trying to duplicate, right? Training also shouldn't be tested for makes because that's not the focus. In training, you're actually training your gets, GET. I know it sounds a little funny. Like, how can you get more shots off in games? So by mastering different types of footwork, that's a way to get more shots off in games. By shooting faster, that's a way to get more shots off in games. By adding levels of movement and speed before the shot, not speed of the shot, that's how you get more shots in games. But that also shouldn't be tested because it will distract you from the focus, right? And while that does add layers of stress, right, it's also not going to be completely game-like because I don't like necessarily training all gets with defense either. Sometimes yes, because part of gets is reads, but not always. So then what should you test? You should test what you should test, which is our testing, right? So constrain to a certain, you know, thing that you've worked on, but then do everything in your power to make your testing as game-like as possible. So you can test by adding speed from a clock. You can test by adding defense and reads. But the goal is to get your testing degradation to zero, or it's not an ideal test. So like having those three different lenses for shot training will, I think, allow faster and greater growth, but also more accurate analysis of game-like effectiveness as well.
I disagree with all that. No, I'm just
I love
kidding.
that. Go ahead.
No, very well said. Only thing I would add is yes, block shooting. We always did it. We called it, we had some individual shooting drills where we would block some shots. Goal for that, you call it tune, which I love. I love the TTT, teach, train, test. We shot for comfort and confidence. It was, let's get it feeling right. And that was actually part of our dynamic. So if you came to, or part of our warm-up, if you came to one of our practices, we might do exactly something like you just did with the footwork and the dribbling, and then go right into a block shooting drill. And that's just part of getting our heart rate up, getting our shots in before we get full go.
Yeah, I agree. That's what we do as well. When we have less players in the gym than this, with more hoops than the one we have in this gym as well, I would be a big proponent to have shooting in every part of your pre-practice if you have the space and numbers. Okay, chop this one up for me. So this is our Q1, and this is actually a new video, Mark. I think there may be an example of this in our drill book. I would love to, if you can actually mark this clip, I'd love to have Mabeth pull this one with the voiceover to add to our drill book in this one. I'll call this one Break and Bolt. And there's so many things. Let me just start with the organization. There's so many things that we're teaching here, but again, our objective was to get our degradation to zero on if no nine protection plan. Failure all over the place, which is great, but also a lot of other things we can teach. All right, so let's check it out. Let me pull it up so I can actually control it with.
While you're pulling that up,
Sorry, what's that?
real fast, what I loved about the quarter one, the quarter two, the quarter is we're gonna all of these skill the skills we worked on in quarter one are gonna bleed throughout the rest of practice. So sign of a master coach.
That's good. I mean, or lucky, or just trying so many things.
That's right. Throwing things against the wall, see what
Yeah,
sticks.
which is interesting though, because the moment you said that, I was like, yeah, that does happen. But honestly, I haven't ever articulated that before. So that's so good.
Yeah. So, and I help a lot of coaches practice plan. It's a big part of the consulting that I do, mainly because I love planning practices. It was something I was really, really passionate about. I took a lot of pride in. And what I got better at is we're going to establish 2-3 desired outcomes or objectives. And those should bleed throughout the entire 90 minutes that you're in there. Instead of, well, we got to get better at transition defense, so we're going to do 10 minutes of transition defense. Well, how can we incorporate transition defense into everything that we do for 90 minutes? That way we're cutting really, really deep instead of cutting broad on 5, 6, 7, where you leave and you're like, what did we actually get better at today?
Yeah, really good. Well, Mark, tell me this. Should I show the organization of this first, like to keep the flow, or should I give the four principles or the four frameworks that I was going to give in how to teach any quarter of your practice? What do you think? Should I come back to the framework, or should I give it before I talk about the drill for the game?
Let's start with the framework and then come back to the drill.
Cool. So Mark was just talking about these things bleeding through practice. One he talked about was transition defense, right? So before planning practice, or before determining what principles that you wanted to bleed through or be themes all through, this is a framework that I think you can help use to clarify what your themes are that you hit over and over and over again. And so I've got 5, but I'm going to actually remove the top one for today. I'll tell it to you, but I won't talk about it because I actually have some examples in a future hours. And the top one is our standards. Like, your standards come first and it bleeds through everything. If at any point you fall below the line of your standards, it's a redo and you uphold that. How you come in and out, your, you know, anything. But I'm not going to talk about that right now because we have spent a lot of time on that in our last cohort call for our Grow community. But that would be the first one, is like, how do your standards consistently carry through everything that you do in your practice? That would be one. What standard are you holding today? Okay, we're leaving that one out. So here's the next framework that I think would help you understand what you keep coming back to. There's 4 of them. I'll give you all 4 if you're taking notes. Our shots, our time, our space, our people. So I've already given you the example of our shots. We hunt 9s first. And so our shots showed up in our pre-practice protection plans, right? Our shots will show up here as well. Which we're going to say, okay, 9s first. If no 9, use your protection plan and get your partner for a 7, but never let one player stop you. If 2 players stop you, someone's open for a 7. You never have to beat 2 players to be great. Beat 1, draw 2, get a 7, right? That's our shots. Now, every one of our principles, because we believe in practicing both offense and defense at the same time, every one of our principles has the inverse, right? Which our shots on defense is make every drive a pass first. We'll work about the second thing that we're doing second, but we cannot, and I told them this, I said, we will not allow a dribbled in layup here, especially not to the right hand. So if there's a dribbled in layup, make that dribble in a pass. There are no 9s. Offense get a 9, defense don't let them get a 9. So that's what we're teaching. I didn't even touch how we make every catch a dribble by flying and closing them off. We're not there yet. Second, our time. So our time on offense is we want to get the majority of our shots up in the first 7 seconds of the shot clock. So how do we do it in this one? There was a 7-second shot clock. From the moment that the ball handler catches the ball at half court, they have 7 seconds to score. That's our time. I'm not going to go into our time defensively yet because that would be a much longer conversation. And the biggest thing I disagree with my friend Mike Neighbors about. Third, our space. Offensively, we must lock down the corner in transition to give the ball handler massive space. And so we're working on that. Defensively, we want to shrink space. We must put the ball handler to the only help that's on the floor and away from the triple or infinite wide gap on the other side of the floor. So we have a space component to our teaching. All of our assistant coaches know that these are the only things that you're teaching, right? Our shots, our time, our space, our people. I'm not touching our people right now. We haven't gotten into roles, reads, what people are constrained to do or not do. Everyone can do everything. And the rule is that everyone hunts a 9. If no 9, kick for a 7. Everyone shoots a 7. If no 7, you know, drive the close out or click it if you got no advantage. So that's our framework for our teaching. And I would just encourage you, like, know what your definition of our shots, our time, our space, and our people is. And those are the things that should bleed through your entire practice. Before I show this drill, Mark, any cleanup on that or any additional thoughts or changes?
No, very well said. If I was adding anything, it would just be for fluff.
Say it again.
I said, if I added anything to that, it would just be for the sake of talking. So I thought you did a very, very good job on explaining.
That's wise. Interject here on any point. All right. 2v2 breakout. We have a rule that anyone that gets a rebound, steal, whatever, must break out first. Pass ahead for a nine. If no nine, you're going. Everyone is their own outlet. So on every transition, we love continuous stuff here at Savvy as well. On every transition, whoever gets the ball, wherever they get the ball, they're breaking out, right? We also teach our racker, or what we call our point guard, that you don't hang around for the outlet. You get up and out. And so we're training everyone here to get up and out regardless of position. So they're catching it up at half court. Now we're live 2-on-2 back to the rim. Next defensive team coming on. Jayla, the girl up top in the white shirt right here, she doesn't hold our space. As soon as she gives the ball, she should have been locking down the ball, the left corner. We're constraining that. But she spaces there, whatever, fine. Okay, so on ball defenders trying to lock left, right? We don't take away a nine. We fail initially, right? Offense does a great job, gets a nine, right? If no nine, she should have done a protection plan, but I love her read here. Our help side here, Melvin, the help side in the white shirt, should have sold out with a scram here to make sure that there's no nine, because the on-ball defender, Natalie's beat, should have scrammed out, and it didn't happen. So there's so many teachable moments there, but I didn't stop the game to teach. That is the job of our assistant coaches and myself. Once we flow, I talk to them when they get off and they're in line, because we want to keep flowing here. All right. So, Claire, this she's one of our best rackers here. You can see she's super dynamic. She can get downhill, so it's great for her. All right, so we're immediately flowing. Breakout, bolt, kick, right? Filling it. Now doing a good job of locking left and trying to constrain the space, right? Really good job turning her back. This is also an opportunity for our locks in the corner that if we ever can't hunt. So here the ball handler can't hunt. They can't crack the shell. They can't get inside the arc. If they can't hunt, it's their trigger to unlock. So they get to blast or burn, right? So we get an unlock for a burn. Nice. Okay. So great job reading it. It's continuous. We're flowing. I stopped for a little bit of teaching. Let me fast forward because there's no audio on this one here. Good. This would be an example of our shots defensively, right? Our shots defensively is anything but a nine or a seven, right? So we force an off the dribble pull up here. Yeah, it's a three. We'd like to be inside the arc. We'd like a little more pressure, but that's our shot there. So that's something that we're celebrating. We're training both sides of the ball here. Let's see a couple more possessions. We can coach through it. We get a late blast at the corner. Okay. We get a nine. We get a nine, and it's not our defensive space. We give up a right hand drive to the infinite gap to the right, you know. So there we go, foul drawn, whatever. Okay, we're moving on. This is a really good job defensively. So this is, we're training both sides of the ball here. Pretty good job spacing, right? Great job turning a right hand drive back into our space defensively, right? We get a little burn cut from the corner. Great read on the back of the head burn from the corner. Offensively, this is what the teaching was for Layla here as a girl with the ball. Right here, she has no nine protection plan. If she goes into a protection plan right there, she has vision and eyes for that burn cut. But because she doesn't go into protection plan, we miss that moment of the open burn cut, right? So that's kind of our connections here. And that's like the teaching. She goes into that protection plan a little bit late. And so these are just the examples of everything that we're teaching. Same thing here. Right here on this drive, we have no nine. She should immediately go into protection plan. She doesn't. She over dribbles. She gets in what we call the manure strip, where only crappy things happen along the baseline. She gets in the manure strip, turnover. Right. So like, these are all teachable moments. They're failures of like, okay, we're not using protection plans. Gosh, I put one good clip in here. We did get a good protection plan. Good, great protection plan right there. Right? No nine immediately stops. and we get a closeout catch. So that would be an example of 2v2 break and bolt with an emphasis on nines and protection plans. Mark, anything to add on any of that? As I'll just let this play in the background so coaches can see it.
Yeah. So the very first clip, we got
back
a nine.
To it or no?
Yeah, you can go back if you can find it quickly. I'm curious, just from a lock left perspective, and then I'll add some just some teaching tools or just some practice method feedback. But we gave up a nine. What would, if you were going to stop and coach, or if you're going to coach that coach on the side, what is the teaching point there?
So three things I would teach the defense here. First, the on-ball defender, Natalie, it picks up way too late and way too low, giving a more of a north-south attack as opposed to getting the ball earlier, closer to the sideline, which gives a much less direct route to the rim. So she's way too low first, right? Second thing is, and it's tough because they cleared out this side, but the second thing is Melvin, or the help side defender right here, should be in the smile, according to the lock left right now. She should be in the smile. She's the low wall. And so Natalie does her job getting the ball left, but right there, I would call shoulders by, and we want to make this a pass. And so Melvin, as the low man in the smile, should be meeting the ball early now and pushing Natalie to scram out to this other player. So that would be the second piece to it, right? And the third piece to it is this. While I did say, okay, this is a nine, I actually would say, right, this is a tough finish, actually. And so if this is what we're giving up occasionally, I'm pretty okay with it. That's a tough finish on the move with a little like duck under righty scoop. So that would be the third thing, is like, that's the shot that we will give up in the lock left when we don't execute well. What we don't want to give up in the lock left is that to the right-hand side of the floor. I would say that's probably like a, you know, on the effective field goal percentage, that's probably at high school level, 60% shot, 50 by a weaker player, or 40,
yeah,
right?
Maybe,
right.
I would say even less than 60, probably.
Even less than 60, right? Yeah. So like we can handle that a percentage of the time.
Yeah. So yeah, and that's the gray area. That's like the nuance, right? Is that a nine? Is that a five? Like it kind of depends on who it is, too. But also, like, we'd call that small advantage. Like I picture a nine as like big advantage, wide open. That's like, it's borderline, right? The only thing I would say is defense didn't close any space. Like there's no contact there. So maybe it's more, maybe it's more nine-ish than five-ish, but it's right there in that gray area. And I would just say, as long as we all have a consistent lens. So in our program, we all can refer to that as the same number, my program thinks it's a five, yours thinks it's a nine, doesn't really matter as long as we're all consistent. And then the other thing I would say is, like, if this was a practice setting for me, absolutely agree. Let's coach those points on the side. One coach should coach one ball defender of the teaching points you said. Another coach, or the same coach, could go to the other player and say, hey, look, you know, you were the low wall. You should have been in the smile. You could have forced the scram switch there. If that becomes a pattern, right? So maybe we go 3-4 reps and our low wall is not where they need to be. Our on-ball defender's not where they need to be. Now we might stop and teach the whole group, because the whole group needs training. What I would tell coaches is, if it happens once, don't stop it. Like, stop for patterns of behavior.
Yeah, absolutely. And even going back, like, this would bleed into our people. Your racker is your best player at getting to and finishing at the rim. So like, this girl with the ball right here is our racker one, right? She's a national level player. That's why she's a racker. She gets to take those shots. Most other players don't. Most other players, I want going into a protection plan there. And the best way to turn that dial as a coach is just to determine time of possession, right? Structure your transition roles, or structure like your spacing and whatnot, to have more time of possession, ball in hand, for racker one, right, as your best finisher. That's easier than saying, you know, so-and-so, you got to be really good at reading whether it's a nine or a five. Five just being like a so-so shot, right? And so like, even like, this is like great read, but it's like only the racker can make that tough read and pass, right? I mean, you don't want your, you know, weaker ball handler, they're never even going to see that thing, right? Yeah. One other lock left thing is here, and I'll share this. Good job on the ball, off the ball, and lock left. This would be our gap defender, the girl in orange, Z. Z needs to be way heavier in the gap in this scenario, and she needs to have her chest open to the ball a little bit more. So I'd say like one more step into the gap, chest more open to the ball, ready to scram or skirmish, right? So it, now it's too late.
She got
now,
there.
Again,
she got
we're in the late. Same situation. Is this a nine? I'm going to say no, right? Especially on who, but also like there's more contact. It's the same foot, same left hand. Like this is the shot we will give up in the lock left, right? Like we're going the other way on that miss. So anyway, that's kind of another example of like the same exact scenario when we're talking about what's the EFG of that. All right, Mark, let's finish up with this. I'm going to ask you defensively, I'd love to hear more about your personal defensive philosophy. I think many coaches would. I'm going to ask you, what would you define as the shortest, highest level defensive outcome of these four frameworks that we've talked about? Maybe like you can go and I can go with lock left, you know, your pressure man, then ours, or vice versa, you tell me. But like when you think from the defensive side, our shots, of course, or not of course, many coaches would say, well, we don't want to let them shoot, which is foolish. I think that if you just say, well, no, the goal of defense is to not let them shoot or score. No, the majority of possessions will end in shots, period. So decide what those shots are defensively, right? So what would be your answer for our shots for you on defense?
So the ones we allow or the ones we take away or both?
Ooh, yeah, whichever you like. I was going, my mind was the ones we allow. Like this is a successful defensive possession if, but I mean, they're tied together. So answer however you like.
Yeah, I mean, if you understand it, you can explain it to a five-year-old, right? So in this scenario, I would say fives would be my very, very yeah. short answer. You know, everybody always says tough twos. So we always said, look, there's no rhythm shots from the perimeter. There's no open shots at the rim. No nines, no sevens. What does that leave? That leaves five. So we were willing to give up contested twos, whether they were at the rim or mid-range.
Yep. And it's crazy, like we're the exact same. And then you get into your definition. So those two layups that I just showed, I would actually call both of them fives. Like we like that because the majority of opponents will make, it's 50-50. We'll make it, you know, 50% or less of the time.
And a lot of when I'm looking at our savvy coaches film, especially the coaches I consult with, a lot of it is when I'm looking at their team, they're taking a lot of fives. And I'm saying, like, you probably only have a couple guys that can make or girls that can make that consistently. That is fool's gold. That was always something that, as a coach, I was measuring, especially against our higher level opponents. They're going to give you more fives. And you're like, well, we're getting to the rim. Like, look at our shot chart. We got to the, you know, we got 40 yeah. shots in the paint, but 40 fives is not going to yield a high effective field goal percentage. So that's what we were willing to give up. We worked a lot on not fouling in those situations. So a lot of times we do our small advantage finishing. Again, we're two-way teaching, right? So we're teaching offense and defense in those situations. I would say, you know, along with our shots, how do they get those shots? You know, like how do they have to work for those shots? And are they getting those shots because they are really good decision makers? I think one thing we talked about in our defense, like who we're willing to lose to or what we're willing to give up, because every defense gives something up and takes something away. Our kryptonite was teams that were really, really good decision makers, and they could turn the fives into a seven or a nine. When I saw a team do that, I was like, oof, we're in for a battle. Like, this one's going to be fun, you know, because they are on our level of decision making. So,
and that's rare, right?
Yeah,
that's the minority of teams.
Might have been three teams at the high school level, three teams on our schedule where I was just like, man, this one. And you could see it on both sides of the ball. They turned a 5 into a 7 or a 9. And then offensively, you know, I think offense should be predictable. Like, we drive in, we don't have a 9, so we kick for a 7, or maybe we go click, click, and it turns into a 7. Everybody's like, oh, we know it's coming, right? We're about to shoot a 3. And then all of a sudden they'd rotate and we're neutral. And I'm like, ah, man, this one's going to be tough. Like, this, we're in for a battle here.
Yeah. I love what you said about breaking down film in the number of 5s. It is the lowest hanging fruit for you to improve your offensive efficiency is just to eliminate 5s. And too many coaches shy away from coaching that.
Yep.
I am not anti mid-range. I'm anti 5.
Yep.
Unfortunately.
That goes to our people too. Like, maybe there's only a few that make that mid-range shot, especially the mid-range has had an uptick in the NBA because more people are closing or running people off the line. So you're going to get more mid. It boomerang way to the extreme. And then as defense adjusts to offense, it's going to come back a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
I find kind of the progression of a team offensively, or in particular in their decision-making, you know, the goal of offense is to find the big advantage, find a 7 or a 9. That's really all. We're not trying to run offense. We're trying to find a 7 or a 9. Expanding your advantage. Like you said, the lowest hanging fruit is to take your 5s and turn them into a 7 or a 9. We would talk about expanding our advantage. Can we create? So first level, can we create a small advantage? And then can we turn that small advantage into a big advantage shot, a 7 or a 9? And then can we complete that advantage? Can we take advantage of advantage? That's kind of the progression that I like to see teams go through as they develop as decision makers.
Yeah. You know, I think we'll end it here. I'll give one final thought. We'll go through the rest of the framework. We've got plenty for the next hours. Mark, we've had some good interaction in the live chat. And I'm inviting everyone that's listening recorded, like, use the community channel as your live chat when you listen to the hours. Have it up. Like, let's ask the questions. So some great questions and comments in the chat here from our live viewers. If Mark or I were to watch your team play, how would we know that you're doing a good job coaching? Infinite answers, but I'll give mine. Here's three signs of a well-coached team. And just so you know, take it for what it's worth, coaches, if I was watching your team play, hardly any of my evaluation would be watching you coach the game. Nearly all of my evaluation would be watching your team play the game. And so, you know, I don't know if you as coaches have ever felt this. I know I have. Like, when someone has watched me coach or come to a game, like, I'm like, oh, I want to show them my coaching. And I would just encourage you to release yourself from that, because that's often the sign of a novice coach. Three things that your team can do or won't do that I would say would be signs of a good coach. One, your team shot selection is the biggest sign of a well-coached team. 2, team's transition defense, biggest sign of a well-coached team. In fact, it's the number one reason why I designed Race and Space the way I did, is I think it's one of the worst coached things. And it's checklist number one when you step up into a game, make that coach on the other sideline show you that they've coached transition defense well. Make them show it to you right away. Put the pressure on immediately, because most coaches can't do it. 2, 3, and I'm going to lump a couple things in together here, but I'm going to call it team communication. Like, you can hear a well-coached team, but like, I would include bench etiquette, bench involvement, like the conversations, like there's active conversation on and off the court amongst players and coaches. For me, those are three signs of a well-coached team. How about you, Mark?
Oh man, it would be hard. I think shot selection. I love that one as the number one. I also think when you talk about the bench energy, right? The bench energy and the connectedness of the team, I do think that is a great measurement of a well-coached team. And I would say shot selection and that connected piece, you can be a really, really good, great tactical coach, but if you're not investing in your culture, still going to fall flat. I tell if you've seen, this is not a brag because this is why I'm in the business, is I help teams do what we were able to achieve. And we took really great shots. Coaches really respected the way we moved the ball. And I think we could do all the drills or games or teaching points, but I always said, I think it's a direct reflection of your culture too, your shot selection and the way you move the ball.
Yeah. Agreed. Really good. Okay. We're over time. And I hate to stop because I'm having so much fun. But that's what's great about this too. It's like not stopping for every mistake in your pre-practice. We don't need to stop and talk about everything here. But I do have one fun question on the way out because I'm ready to say something different than I've said before in my life. But I have a great question for you. In your opinion, Coach Cassio, who is the greatest of all time? Who is your GOAT and why?
This would be coach.
I was thinking player, but you may go coach if you like.
Okay. No, I'll go player. Greatest of all time and why?
Yeah.
I'm a child of the 90s, man. I gotta go Michael Jordan. Why? I think his resume speaks for himself, so resume speaks for itself as far as winning. But also just how driven he was and the competitor that he was.
Great. And you can see that I have two pictures of your GOAT behind me here. And yet I'm going to disagree. I've been flirting with this and evaluating it for a couple of years now, but I'm willing to stand by this now. Unequivocally, in my opinion, LeBron James is the greatest player of all time.
Really?
And in my opinion, it is now not even close. And let me, you're getting some support in the chat right now. I know people are going to disagree with me. All right, let me argue with you on 3 points here. And then feel free to rebut. One, LeBron James is a better player than Michael Jordan. I just watched significant game film of Michael Jordan. Who he was playing against, what his actual skill set was, his actual just speed and athleticism, like in raw numbers, LeBron James is better. And I'm saying that confidently now. Okay, all right, okay, fine. I know what you're going to say, right? If Michael Jordan played at this time and had access to all the, okay, go ahead.
No, not what I was going to say.
Okay.
Here's a point. I actually thought you were going to go Kobe. So I'm a little shocked. All right. But this kind of goes with Kobe too.
Yeah.
All right. How many guys in the NBA, even when Jordan played, looked like Michael Jordan? Size?
Right. Very few.
A lot. I would say a lot, right? Like, what was Jordan? 6'6"?
Yeah.
So, I guess how many?
I was thinking about like athleticism and like explosiveness and grace and beauty, but looked like him. Yes, I agree.
Yeah, so and he was he separated himself from a lot of other dudes that looked exactly like him. I would say the same thing for Kobe. How many NBA players looked like Kobe physically? He was able to separate himself so far from dudes that had probably just as much athleticism, size, strength. How many dudes in the NBA look like LeBron? I would
Fair
say less.
Point, but I would argue not zero.
Not zero, not Giannis, but he's pretty.
Right? I mean, like I would say, yeah. I mean, I would say like there's been physical specimens as well.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. I mean, I'm with you.
Like, I get your point on that, though.
Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah. Okay. Here's my second point. So I'm stating that LeBron James is a better basketball player than Michael Jordan, and I know that that is a very controversial take. Second, duration. He's 20 years. What, Jordan had like an 8-year peak, 7-year peak, right? LeBron has been doing this at an MVP-ish level for 18 years. Take away his first two seasons, all right? That's more than double.
He has, it's pretty incredible because LeBron and I are the same age.
Oh, okay.
It's probably the only thing we have in common.
LeBron and I have the same body.
That's right. Same age and we dunk the same.
Right.
But he has been in the NBA longer, for more than half of his life. Or right at half of his life. Think about that.
Right.
I mean, that is incredible. And, you know, I'll just say it, like, LeBron, if you're listening, I apologize. I've never been a huge fan because I went from Jordan to Kobe, and Kobe and LeBron were playing at the same time, and the torch was just never passed to LeBron for me. But in a non-social media age, like, LeBron probably would have, if he doesn't already, have as much mystique as Michael Jordan. I do think there's some like legend to Michael Jordan that if you do peel back the curtain, I'm just not willing to do that. I choose not to look behind the curtain.
I'm trying to peel back the curtain for people here, and I understand it took me a long time to get here as well. I'll give you a third one. In my opinion, based on what I've read, first person accounts and just like observation, I like LeBron James more. I think that Michael Jordan, and I think it came out in many of these documentaries, like, he was a selfish jerk that was not politically active in any way. Whereas I feel like LeBron James, and who had, you know, conspiracy theories aside, you know, gambling addictions, you can talk about like all of his relationships. I mean, you know, like, LeBron has been squeaky clean under the spotlight, has given away more money than Michael Jordan times. Like, Jordan didn't do any of this foundation stuff. You're a jerk, MJ. Screw you, man.
Like, he may be listening. He may be listening.
I don't care. All right, I'll tell it to your face. Okay. Like, LeBron is the GOAT, man. Like, he's done more for like underprivileged communities, right? Like, more for the game, more for player empowerment. Like, you know, striking back against shut up and dribble, like giving more opportunities for players and media. Like, anyway, LeBron James is my GOAT.
I will say, it's, you know, it's not zero sum. You're kind of pushing me back okay. I could be swayed probably. I'll also say that was kind of the cool thing about, and I know we're wrapping up here, but that was the cool thing about Kobe's evolution.
Yeah.
Is, you know, he tried to emulate Jordan in everything he did, and he kind of came in with that, like, that killer instinct that was almost too much, like, Michael had. And then he started to figure out how to use that to get the best out of people, which still had the Mamba mentality, obviously. But I think he did it in a way that was more gracious a little bit and more endearing to the public.
Agreed. And and what Kobe did in his, you know, short stint post-retirement, you know, specifically giving back to the game for the women's game. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is just so sad. Like, I think another 20 years of him being an ambassador would have done so much for the game and the women's game in particular. So a ton of respect for that, because Kobe, I think, is in that conversation as well.
Okay. I was going to add, that's what's going to be my last question for today, is Kobe even in the conversation for you?
I think absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I would even argue that by my metric, I think Kobe, became a better peak player than Michael Jordan in absolute terms, not relative terms. I mean, things get better, not worse. Things go forward, not backwards. You know, most mediocre players today, minimum contract players today, would be absolute superstars 20 years ago, which is just the reality of progression, right? So I speak in absolute terms as well, not relative. So, and I'm not a big rings guy either. There's just so many factors.
True. And we're talking almost 30 years of Jordan now in prime, you know, which is crazy.
It's crazy. So,
yeah, I'm with it.
Well, this was a pleasure. Thank you to those of you that stuck around with us to the very end. And thank you to those that are going to be listening to recorded. Okay. Daryl Carr says that duration is my strongest argument. But he's still, I think he's still a Jordan guy with you, Mark. So you got him. Yes. And the best we've seen, LeBron, he says, is the best we've seen to give credit to his team of advisors, which is true. So appreciate you all tuning in. This is Mark. I'm Tyler. We are Savvy Coaching, and we look forward to next time on The Hours.
Stay savvy.
Stay savvy.